From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Russia annexing Crimea. Iran talks underway between Russia and the West. Nigeria launching a soft approach to counter Boko Haram, plus the search for the missing Malaysian passenger plane. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Russian President Vladimir Putin and Crimean leaders have signed a treaty to make Crimea a part of Russia. VOA Steve Herman has more from the Ukrainian capital, Kiev.
Much to the dismay of the interim government here in Kiev, which could only watch helplessly, Russian President Vladimir Putin in Moscow signed a treaty that will incorporate the Ukrainian province of Crimea into Russia. This comes less than a month after Ukraine's president, Viktor Yanukovych, fled the capital after his forces killed protesters. During an address to Russia's parliament, which was nationally televised live in both Russia and Ukraine, Mr. Putin condemned the Kiev leaders who replaced Mr. Yanukovych, saying they have abused the rights of ethnic Russians in Crimea. Mr. Putin also declared Kiev the cradle of Russian civilization and expressed hope Russia and Ukraine can continue to coexist. Steve Herman, VOA News, Kiev.
Tuesday's action by President Putin came in the wake of that weekend referendum we've been telling you about, in which residents of Crimea voted overwhelmingly to join Russia. But as VOA's senior correspondent Andrei Dineshnra tells us, many outside experts are raising questions about the legitimacy of the vote.
The reported results of the referendum in Crimea were overwhelming. 97% of those voting cast their ballots to join Russia. The announced voter turnout was over 80%. Russia's President Putin said the referendum complied with international and democratic norms. But many analysts, including Robert Legvold with Columbia University, questioned the outcome.
If it was an honest vote and all groups had participated, I would have thought, rather than an overwhelming vote, it would have been something like 52% to 53%, given the percentages of the percentage makeup of the groups in Crimea. The fact that it's 97 point whatever, and they report a turnout of 83%, creates some suspicion that it wasn't just the shadow of the Russian military presence, but maybe even some manipulation.
Matthew Rojansky with the Wilson Center says pro-Russian authorities in Crimea would not have held a referendum if they didn't have a high confidence in the outcome.
My sense is this was a product of the times, in which there's been a real buildup of fear-mongering and the overt pressure of armed men. There's nothing quite like a gun in your face.
The United States and the European Union described the referendum as illegal and violating the Ukrainian constitution. Washington and Brussels reacted swiftly, imposing travel bans and trade sanctions on 28 Russian officials and 4 Ukrainians. The White House said those targeted are Mr. Putin's cronies. Once again, Matthew Rojansky.
The people that Putin really relies on, are close enough to him that, A, they're prepared to lose. They are easily prepared to suffer the consequences of those individual sanctions. And second, Putin has specifically helped them to limit the consequences of those individual sanctions.
Rojansky says over the last year and a half, Mr. Putin urged senior Russian officials to divest themselves from their international holdings. In other words, bring their wealth back to Russia.
Anybody who's complied with him is sitting pretty and doesn't have to worry about the international sanctions. And anyone who didn't, well, it's their problem, and he can cut them loose.
Rojansky believes the current sanctions are not strong enough, given the fact that Russia has invaded another country. U.S. officials have made clear more sanctions will come if Mr. Putin continues to move against Ukraine.
I don't think Putin believes us. I don't think he thinks we actually have the guts to impose really biting sanctions on, for example, the energy sector. I think he just distrusts our resolve because we haven't made it clear that we're willing to pay the pain on our side.
Robert Legvold says stronger sanctions could have a negative effect on the global economy.
Every step that escalates the penalty or the punishment also escalates the cost to those imposing the sanctions.
Analysts say it will be very difficult, if not impossible, to reverse what has happened in Crimea. Experts also say it will be interesting to see how far the United States and its Western allies are willing to go to punish Russia for its actions. Andrei Dineshnera, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. Vice President Joe Biden is in Poland for talks aimed at reassuring Eastern European allies that they have the support of the United States, especially in light of Russia's annexing of Crimea. Henry Ridgewell is following the story.
Standing alongside Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk, US Vice President Joe Biden condemned Moscow's move to make Crimea part of Russia.
Russia has offered a variety of arguments to justify what is nothing more than a land grab.
Mr. Biden landed in Warsaw Tuesday for a visit designed to reaffirm the United States' protection for its allies in Eastern Europe, while also discussing ways to reduce their dependence on Russian energy. He also is to meet leaders from Estonia, Latvia and Lithuania, all part of the former Soviet Union. These nations look primarily to the United States, not Europe, as their security guarantor, says Nicholas Redman, senior fellow at the International Institute for Strategic Studies.
It's actually the power that really lies behind NATO, the United States, that's the one that they are looking to principally and that they need the reassurance from.
Close to the Arctic Circle, NATO troops are currently training in northern Norway, part of Exercise Cold Response 2014, planned before the Ukraine crisis erupted. The Russian border is just 450 kilometres away. Norwegian General Major Morten Hager Lund directs the exercise.
This is one of the biggest live exercises in Europe this year. 16,000 troops, 15 nations.
Next to the Ukrainian border, Russian troops have been conducting their own exercises. Events in Crimea have unnerved the entire region, Redman says.
Even a lot of Russia's closest allies will be very uneasy about this. The former Soviet Union, the borders around those countries are historically without precedent. There are a lot of nations that are trapped on the wrong side of lines. There are a lot of contested borders there.
In response to Russia's actions, the European Union Monday enacted sanctions against 21 Russian citizens, alongside a United States list targeting 11 individuals. British Foreign Secretary William Hague says the measures are indicative of European unity on the issue.
These are individuals not just in Crimea, but in Russia as well, including in the armed forces and in the parliament, people who are associated with the decisions that Russia has made about Crimea.
Russia's foreign ministry says the sanctions will lead nowhere, but Europe does have the power to hurt Russia, says analyst Nicholas Redman.
And at the moment, and there's a tension clearly between signalling intent and signalling seriousness, but also leaving enough in reserve on the understanding that things could get worse.
Regional analysts say that possibility is reigniting tensions between Moscow and the West that have lain dormant for two decades. Tensions many had hoped were part of history. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Amid the Crimea controversy, Russian and Western negotiators sat together on Tuesday in Vienna for the next round of talks on Iran's nuclear program. VOA's Al Pessin has our report.
The international negotiating team is made up of the five permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany and is led by the European Union's foreign policy chief, Catherine Ashton, who has issued strong condemnations of Russia's actions in Crimea. But her spokesman, Michael Mann, says the Crimea controversy is not affecting the Iran talks.
The great joy of these discussions so far is that the E3 plus 3 has always remained united, and that is still the case. I haven't seen any negative effect at all. We will continue our good work in a unified fashion.
A senior U.S. official who spoke on condition of anonymity had a similar assessment, saying all six countries representing the United Nations remain completely united and are very cohesive on the Iran nuclear issue. The official expressed hope that whatever happens in the days ahead regarding Russia and Crimea will not put these negotiations at risk. The aim of the Vienna talks is to reach a comprehensive agreement to guarantee Iran's nuclear program is only for peaceful purposes, as Iran says it is. Many countries and experts believe Iran is developing the capability to build a nuclear bomb. The talks follow on from an agreement reached in Geneva in November, which expires in July. UN and U.S. officials say Iran is fulfilling its commitments under that accord, including the dilution of its stockpile of near-weapons-grade uranium to a safer level. The United States and other countries have responded with limited relief from economic sanctions as agreed. The senior officials have been meeting monthly for several days, with lower-level technical specialists meeting more frequently. Experts say they do not expect any agreement until very close to the deadline, if one can be reached at all. Everyone involved emphasizes how difficult the issues are, including international demands for even more intrusive inspections and the dismantling of some Iranian nuclear facilities. The UN team also wants to discuss Iran's missile program, which the Iranian negotiators say should not be part of these negotiations. Again, EU spokesman Michael Mann.
I wouldn't like to make any predictions of how things are going to go, because we've said all along that these are going to be very complicated and difficult negotiations. So we'll keep pushing on. The most important thing is that a deal is done that is a good, solid deal that everyone can live with and everyone's happy with. And clearly, to do that as quickly as possible is also important, but it's the quality of the deal that counts.
Earlier, the senior U.S. official declined to discuss specifics of the talks, but said they are moving forward in a positive way and that all parties are intent on succeeding before the deadline. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
U.S. officials have told the Syrian embassy here in Washington to suspend operations. They say any Syrian diplomat and any of them who are not U.S. citizens or lawful permanent residents must leave the country. The order also affects Syria's two honorary consulates in the U.S. However, U.S. Special Envoy for Syria Daniel Rubenstein said the United States wants to maintain diplomatic relations with Syria as an expression of longstanding ties with the Syrian people, something he said will endure long after Bashar al-Assad leaves power. Meantime, the UN human rights negotiators are saying the perpetrators of crimes during Syria's civil war will not be escaping justice. Paulo Pinheiro is chairman of the UN Commission of Inquiry. He says the commission has drawn up a list of those responsible for violations and crimes during the civil war.
The perpetrator list contains names of persons criminally responsible for hostage-taking, torture, and executions. It also contains names of the heads of intelligence branches and detention facilities where detainees are tortured, names of military commanders who target civilians, airports from which barrel bomb attacks are planned and executed, and armored groups involved in attacking and displacing civilians.
Syrian Ambassador Faisal Hamas Hamoui rejects the report. He accuses the investigators of relying on manipulative testimony and false media reports. He calls it biased and politicized.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
The search is now in the 12th day for the missing Malaysian passenger plane. More than two dozen countries are involved in the search, which so far has not turned up anything. Malaysian authorities say the search for the airliner with 239 people aboard has been expanded to cover more than 7 million square kilometers. Thai Chief Air Marshal Prajin Juntong released new radar information on Tuesday that could support earlier reports that the Malaysia Airlines jet made a sharp turn to the west toward the Strait of Malacca after it lost contact. Its last contact recorded early March the 8th north of Malaysia. The plane was on a scheduled flight from Kuala Lumpur to Beijing. Meantime, U.S. law enforcement officials say investigators searching a home flight simulator and emails of the pilots of the missing airliner have failed to find any evidence that either pilot purposely steered the flight away from its destination. China's foreign ministry, its spokesperson Hong Lei, was asked at the Tuesday press briefing about China's efforts to help find the missing Malaysian plane.
根据马方的请求，我们在 马方提出的
Hong said they are using satellites and radar in the search, but gave no details as to where it was looking. Satellite data showed the plane could have ended up anywhere in a giant arc stretching from Kazakhstan and Central Asia to the southern reaches of the Indian Ocean west of Australia. You can keep up to date on the search for Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 by going to our website at voanews.com. Also in the news, Nigeria's National Security Advisor has unveiled plans for a new non-military strategy to combat a four-and-a-half-year-old Islamist insurgency that's killed thousands of people. The strategy would complement, not replace, military efforts to fight the radical sect Boko Haram. Heather Murdoch reporting now from Abuja.
About 10 months ago, Nigeria launched its biggest military push ever against Boko Haram insurgents, imposing emergency rule on three northeastern states. Many urban centers were quickly secured, but the violence continued in the countryside. More recently, northern cities have again come under attack. Human Rights Watch says 700 people have been killed this year alone. Amid the growing violence, Nigeria's National Security Advisor, Sambo Dasuki, says the government will take a soft approach to counterterrorism, in addition to military efforts.
My approach has been to understand the problem in order to apply the appropriate solutions. What we have learned is that there is not one particular path that leads to terrorism, rather there are many. Often complicated paths that lead to terrorism.
Poverty, social injustice, isolation, and sectarianism are among the causes of insurgency, he says. And prison reform, economic development, peace talks, and educating the public are among the solutions. Under the plan, two prisons will become de-radicalization facilities. The next step, Dasuki says, is to train the staff.
The initiative will require substantial capacity building of prison staff in areas such as psychology, sports and arts therapy, faith-based instructors, and vocational training experts that would engage beneficiaries.
Another key tenet of the soft approach to counterterrorism, he says, is economic reform in northeastern Nigeria, where most people live in abject poverty, fueling the insurgency. But the insurgency also makes the region poor, adds Gebenro Olajuyubi, a human security manager at anti-poverty organization Action Aid. The soft approach, he says, needs to follow better security on the ground.
If people are in an insecure environment, economies are collapsed, rights are collapsed, there's intrusion of fear. I think the best thing to do is to stabilize the country a bit before you put that one.
The United Nations calls the Boko Haram insurgency increasingly monstrous, saying nearly 500,000 people have fled their homes and tens of thousands have fled into neighboring countries. Farmers have also abandoned their fields, threatening food security in many areas. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
Witnesses in central Somalia say Al-Shabaab militants have killed at least six people. Happened in an attack on a town that they lost last week to government and African forces. A VOA reporter in Mogadishu said those killed in Bulo Berde early on Tuesday included a senior Somali military commander. Residents reported heavy gunfire between Al-Shabaab fighters and a group of Somali and Djiboutian fighters as well. There were also reports of explosions. Somali National Army and troops from Amazon recaptured Bulo Berde last Thursday in what Amazon called a major victory. Town is 200 kilometers north of Mogadishu, and Amazon said it was home to hundreds of Al-Shabaab fighters. The countries around Lake Chad in Central Africa say they will create a joint task force to combat arms trafficking, terrorism, and cross-border attacks as tensions escalate in the region. Moki Edwin Kenzita reports now from Yaoundé.
The conflict in the Central African Republic and the insurgency in northern Nigeria are having a regional impact, pushing refugees, weapons, and violence into neighboring countries. In response, defense and military chiefs from the six-member Lake Chad Basin Commission met in Cameroon Tuesday and gave a green light to a multinational military task force empowered to act against militant threats. Cameroun's defense minister, Edgar Aleme Bengo.
Cette réunion devrait représenter l'électrochoc à partir duquel le bassin du lac Tchad.
He says this meeting was sort of a shock therapy for Lake Chad Basin member states to address how best to tackle growing threats and the growing security challenges. Cameroon has been hit particularly hard by the chaos in the CAR and the Boko Haram attacks in northern Nigeria. Refugees from both countries have streamed into Cameroon, while officials have denied allegations that militants are using Cameroonian territory as a refuge or a base for operations. Nigerian-born Sanusi Imran Abdullah is the executive secretary for the Lake Chad Basin Commission. He says the new task force will be headquartered in the town of Baga in Nigeria's Borno State, the home state of Boko Haram.
Bagakawa is the institution or the place that is fully prepared to accommodate a headquarter. As you know, there are buildings there are infrastructure there, and there is no need to build a new place.
Borno is one of three Nigerian states where the government declared a state of emergency last May and has deployed thousands of troops in an effort to crush the Boko Haram insurgency. Despite the oppressions, large-scale attacks on towns and cities continue. Chad, Cameroon, Libya, Niger, Nigeria, and the CAR agreed that the initial mandate of the new task force will be to patrol the Lake Chad region, conduct military operations against arms dealers and suspected terrorists, and to facilitate free movement. Operations are to begin soon, but no firm date has been announced. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaounde.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry told U.S. students on Tuesday he had talked with Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni recently, and that Mr. Museveni committed to meet with some American experts to discuss Uganda's anti-gay law, which has triggered international outrage. State Department spokesperson Jennifer Saki said the enactment of the Homosexuality Act was a step backward to Uganda. The law is more than an affront, she says, and a danger to the gay community in Uganda. U.S. administration has been looking at ways to rein in its aid to Uganda as punishment for the law and has decided not to resume paying salaries of 18 top Ugandan health officials.
Now that the Anti-Homosexuality Act has been enacted, we're continuing to look closely at the implications of the new law, and where appropriate, we have adjusted some activities and engagements while we are doing that. So let me give you an example. We have been funding the salary top-off, so additional salary to help pay 18 health officials, senior health officials. That expired last month. That is something where we are no longer providing that top-off payment.
Last month, President Museveni signed off on one of the world's toughest anti-gay laws, despite warnings from his Western allies. The new law states that repeat homosexuals should be jailed for life. It also outlaws the promotion of homosexuality and requires citizens to report on gays.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
24 ethnic or minority U.S. soldiers who perform bravely under fire in three of the nation's recent wars received medals of honor that the government concluded should have been awarded a long time ago. That happened on Tuesday. The servicemen, Hispanics, Jews, and African Americans were identified following a congressionally mandated review to ensure that eligible recipients of the country's highest recognition for valor were not bypassed due to prejudice. Only three of the 24 were alive for President Obama to drape the medal and ribbons around their necks on Tuesday in a ceremony at the White House. And officials in Port-au-Prince say a drought is causing an extreme emergency in northeast Haiti, wiping out needed crops and livestock. The usually arid area has not seen some rain lately, but not as much as they need to replenish the crops. Haiti and its 10 million people are especially vulnerable to the whims of weather. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. A reminder, you can always find us on the internet at voanews.com. Hope you'll stay with us. The latest world news is coming up shortly. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Wednesday.
This is Today in History. On March 19, 1649, in the wake of the English Civil War, the House of Commons passed an act that abolished the House of Lords, declaring it, quoting now, useless and dangerous to the people of England. The upper house did not assemble again until 1660, when the monarchy was restored. Today is St. Joseph's Day, when Roman Catholics honor the husband of Mary, the mother of Jesus. In 1920, the United States Senate rejected the Treaty of Versailles for a second time. A group of senators opposed the part of the treaty that formed the League of Nations, believing provisions of the measure took too much power away from the American government. In 1945, General Friedrich Fromm, the commander of the German Home Army, was executed by firing squad for his part in a plot to assassinate Adolf Hitler. Just months later, the defeated Hitler killed himself amid the ruins of Berlin as the Soviet army overran the city. In 1962, iconic folk singer Bob Dylan released his first album on the Columbia Records label. On this day in 1987, U.S. televangelist Jim Baker resigned in the midst of a sex scandal. Baker was later found guilty of fraud and conspiracy, charges related to his PTL ministry, and sent to jail. On March 19, 2003, President George W. Bush announced that a U.S.-led military assault, Operation Iraqi Freedom, had begun. In 2004, Taiwanese President Chen Shui-bian was shot and slightly wounded just before the country's presidential election on March 20th. The next day, the president narrowly won the election. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Rising political tensions in Burundi ahead of next year's elections have sparked violent clashes between police and opposition activists in recent days. Actions taken by both sides are inconsistent with the Central African nation's notable progress toward creating a peaceful democracy. In two separate incidents on March 8th, government officials took action to break up political gatherings being held by two different opposition parties. Police used heavy-handed tactics to stop a peaceful rally by the women's wing of United for National Progress to mark International Women's Day. Later, police dispersed a gathering of another political opposition party, some of whose members subsequently congregated at the headquarters of the Movement for Solidarity and Democracy political party, or MSD. Two police officers attempting to arrest three MSD members who had taken refuge in the headquarters were taken hostage by opposition members. Following unsuccessful mediation, police assaulted the building to free the hostages. The police and opposition members exchanged live fire during this confrontation. Authorities later issued an arrest warrant on insurgency charges for the MSD's chairman, Alexis Sinduige. The United States deplores the acts of violence by both government officials and opposition members in the incidents, which follow a series of restrictions placed on civil and political rights in Burundi. Restricting public gatherings in this way has a chilling effect on public debate. We urge the government of Burundi to adhere to its human rights obligations and to respect the constitutional right of the political opposition to hold peaceful gatherings. It is also imperative that all sides refrain from the kind of violence seen in the March 8th clashes. It is important that all sides respect the democratic process so that Burundi can hold free, fair, transparent, and peaceful elections in 2015.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.